Beetlegeist. In honor of the founder, what's your favorite Michael Keaton performance?
I'm Katie Richard. I'm going with Tom, the guy who just wants to get through his last day of employment at 30 Rock before it's all filled by a gas leak in the two-part 100th episode of 30 Rock.
Hey, it's me, David the Seventh. It's not necessarily my all-time favorite, but it's important to talk about animation, so the crazy pig-obsessed Trip Larson in King of the Hill.
I'm Matt Patches, and my best man at my wedding actually announced to the entire crowd that I don't really like Michael Keaton. So I should put that out there first, and then I should say that he's quite good in Amy Heckerling's Johnny Dangerously.
I'm David Ehrlich. My favorite part of Matt Patch's wedding is when someone outed him as not liking Michael Keaton, because Michael Keaton sucks and is just super boring and I have no interest in him. And therefore, I am going to insult him by choosing another, well, not pig-obsessed, but pig-ish role in which he doesn't even appear on camera. My favorite Michael Keaton performance is when he dubbed the main character in Porco Rosso for its American release.
There's no way that you like the dubbed version of Porco Rosso.
Nope.
Wow. Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, well then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Fighting in the War Room, episode 151 for Tuesday, January 17th, 2017. And on this day in 2016, were we ever so young, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Remember them? They faced off in their fourth Democratic presidential debate. Fourth. Guys.
Can I talk about how nothing good happened on January 17th through like all history?
Wow. I'm so stunned to just remember the time when Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders debated each other and we thought that was a big problem.
I mean, it's just like, I usually look for something like entertainment related or something we could like joke about, but like, it's like, you know, Eisenhower like reportedly ordered an assassination and like horrible war things happened. I guess there were some Golden Globes, but that just seemed like, nah.
Nah. Let's talk about Bernie. All right. This week, we're getting ready to send Patches and David off to Sundance. So how will you enliven them before they go off to the wilds of Park City? Maybe you'll leave us a review. Did anybody do that this week?
I am told that they did, in fact, which is wonderful. Here we go. Let's fucking do this. Z8R Matt. 5-star says, wild. Period. I've just been listening to this podcast for a couple months, but it's been great. 10 out of 10. Would recommend. I was meaning to write a review anyways, but like, I want the Jackie poster. So if you're looking for a contest, my idea is just to give it to me.
This was a lot of people's ideas for the contest. A little disappointed.
They are not observing the spirit of the contest.
But in the spirit of me reading literally anything that people write to us in reviews, I now have to read three smiley sun faces look like, and his Twitter handle, @MattAAClark. Was this review helpful? David's going to click yes.
Wow.
I love this show, says Conrock. Coming from a gay former Scientologist, okay. See, now this is the part where I remind you that I'm reading these live for the first time. What an opening. Strong opening, Conrock. Coming from a gay former Scientologist, this podcast has been my solace for the past 5 years, dating back to the Operation Kino days. Wow. It's been here for me through a lot of change, leaving the church after the enormous amount of guilt laid upon me for being the gay man that I am. Growing up in a religion that uses guilt and shame to control is not an easy thing. This podcast was here as I was in the midst of an emotionally... It says Andy, I have relationship. I'm assuming that's an autocorrect of some kind, but we'll go with it. It was here while leaving the church, following me to Colorado as I pursued a man who is now my husband! Exclamation point.
Hey. Oh my God.
Congratulations. Ooh. Life has had a lot of uncertainties during these last 5 years, but podcasts like this one got me through. Movies and podcasts about movies weren't just my escape, they were my solace away from the chaos. Podcasts like this... one, have helped to finally push me to create a podcast of my own. So thank you, and much love to you all. Well, thank you, Conrock. I wish you would have told us what your podcast was. But
yeah, no self-promotion.
Yeah,
that has been
Conrock,
too much.
Can we have Conrock as a guest, guys? Yeah. I mean, this sounds, story sounds, if you want to be a guest, you know.
Conrock, if you want to come on for a segment and tell us your story, we would love to have you.
Please tweet at us, email us.
Email, Matt, what's your email?
I think we have a Fighting the War email, but we don't use it.
It's not going to get, just tweet at us. One of us. Yeah, tweet at us. We'll find
you. Know how to find us.
Was this review helpful? Yes.
Of course.
Okay. K. Bailey Java, you bribed me with posters.
Oh, my God.
All caps. I want those posters. Tell me what I have to do to get them. Anyways, I enjoy this show a lot, and I'm so thankful Dave uploaded a year and a half more episodes for me to enjoy as I started listening around March or April 2016. If Katie Rich is involved, count me in.
Hey!
Between Little Gold Men, The Film Experience, and this podcast, we have a name, Kate Bailey Jones. I love my fix of Katie Rich movie discussion. Love Matt, Dave, and Joanna when she appears too, and David grows on me, but always finds something to say to make me angry in regards of a movie I enjoyed, but I respect everyone's wrong opinions.
Same, Kate Bailey Johnson.
Very
makes us
generous
angry too.
Of you. Can't wait to hear what great conversations happen in 2017. Once again, tell me what I have to do to get those posters patches.
We will tell you at the end of this overlong review segment. So there
what,
you go.
Was this review helpful? Yes. JDOS23. Wonderful film discussions. Late to the party, but glad I found the podcast. Really makes you appreciate movies and opens you up to even further explore things you may have not realized or had seen.
Wow.
Thanks. Was this review helpful? Yes.
Yes.
I feel like this is enough for review segment.
We only have one more. One more?
Okay.
My absolute fave podcast, says Taysby. Hi. If someone could read this with a Valley Girl accent, it would be totes appreciated. I just wanted you guys to know that you're one of my favorite podcasts. You've introduced me to movies. I know. I just watched The Crown.
Hello.
Give me a break.
I'm a Valley Girl.
You've introduced me to movies and TV shows. That I would like, have never thought about watching. I can't fucking do it.
I think this is a Happy Valley as in the BBC show.
Isn't this a Joanna trick? This is her jam.
Please keep up the excellent work, good sirs. Also, Charlie should be a podcast regular. I love it when he has something to coo about.
Aww.
Well, we just got to record during the daytime.
This is what Elisa and I do whenever we watch The Crown. Ew. And Claire Foy goes, ew.
Something to coo about was better in British than it would have been in Valley Girl, though.
What? True. Was this review helpful? I'm tempted to click report a concern, but I will go with yes.
David, the fact that you just launched into that accent without any hesitation was so satisfying.
Very brave. Very brave.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm here to satisfy. Here to please.
So, Patches, how can people win these posters?
Yes. So, to wrap this up, we are going to kill two birds with one stone. So if you follow our Facebook page or if you follow our Twitter page, you can see that we are soliciting. We want your ideas for our quarter quell, which in theory would have been this episode, but we didn't have our shit together. And we're about to go to Sundance, and it's crazy. But
we chose to delay it for, satisfaction of the listeners.
We want a great topic to dig into. And if you've listened to our other quarter quell episodes, we get personal, we talk about life, we talk about the future, the past, the present. It's a big ideas, and we talk about, we filter all that through our movie cultural experiences. Go back and listen to those Quarter Quell episodes if you haven't, because for this contest, to win these posters, and actually I found it's not just going to be posters. I have a La La Land record and soundtrack to give
oh
people,
my God.
Like the La
we
La
have
Land poster.
So much crap to give
we
away.
Have the Manchester by the Sea poster, and I have the Jackie poster. They're very, very cool art.
Patches, the Manchester by the Sea poster is signed.
It's signed
by Kenneth Lonergan.
Yeah, so you'll have to tell me also when you leave your submissions for this contest what you would want. I wouldn't, just because La La Land poster comes with an album, don't skip on that Jackie poster. The Jackie poster is very, very cool.
Jackie poster is the best looking of the crowd, I think.
Oh, yeah. Art-wise, Jackie poster. If you want to put it on your wall, Jackie poster. But anyway, Quarter Quell, we're looking for ideas. So how can you win this stuff? Send us your ideas for the Quarter Quell either on Twitter. I have a post up on Facebook right now looking for Quarter Quell submissions. throw your name in, throw your idea in, looking for something we can really put our teeth into, and then tell me what prize you want to win, and I'll be picking, well, I may just give you the prize I want to give you, but the best ones, we're going to give prizes away. I'll figure it out. It's going to be very subjective. I choose, but that's how you win the shit. So there you go.
There you go.
And now on to the show.
So it's January, which is a time when TV can get really rough. There's like all of these different mid-season replacement shows coming on the networks. But as we know, networks are not really where it's at anymore with television. And this time of year, a lot of times HBO would kind of step into the fray, like True Detective premiered in January. Sometimes Silicon Valley and Girls are coming back this time of year. This year, it is pretty much just Young Pope, which has become a meme more than a show, as far as I can tell. Like all
before
of film
it
Twitter,
even aired.
Yeah, all of film Twitter wants to make Young Pope jokes, which in some way makes me want it to be like the show that everyone's going to be watching this January. But David, you're the only one of us who has seen it. I don't know. Is it worth it?
Not any more so than any of Paolo Sorrentino's other things.
Which are?
The Great Beauty, which is my favorite of his films. Il Divo, which came before that. Most recently, Youth. And now The Young Pope, which is definitely a Paolo Sorrentino production from the very first shot, which is a pyramid of CG babies that Jude Law climbs out from beneath. This is...
Because he's a young and a pope?
Yeah, this is, sure. This is on tour television to the extreme. It is very idiosyncratic. I don't think that meme Twitter is prepared for how... I don't know if slow is the right word, but it's a very unsexy show. It is not, like, I thought that the tagline, prior to seeing it, should have been, like, this Pope fucks. But this Pope doesn't fuck. it's about a guy who's actually sort of, I mean, he's essentially, the idea behind his character seems to be as much inner conflict, as much sort of disruption to the church as possible, as much unpredictability between his surface veneer and his personality underneath, as you might think. I mean, he carps all the time about his handsomeness. He talks about Daft Punk and but like he is, you know, in the second episode, there's this whole thing about how he, you know, he's established and he's like the young, cool, sexy Pope. But his whole idea is rather than flaunt that and allow the church to continue profiting off the image of the Pope. And a lot of this show is about the logistics of how the Catholic Church stays in business as a business. He wants to make absolutely no public appearances, to essentially ensconce himself in the Vatican so that the mystery takes hold and he becomes like the sort of mysterious Pope. And
he's like the Steve Jobs of popes.
He compares himself to, he wants to be the Daft Punk of popes. He compares himself to Banksy, I think. You know,
does he wear a giant Pope head?
He does. No. Yeah. And they try to prey upon his youthfulness by seducing him with an actress whom I reckon... it's not Cécile de France, even though she's in it. I can't remember off the top of my head who it is, but he is not having
it. Diane Keaton?
No, Diane Keaton plays his maternal... See, he's like a brash American Pope.
Cécile de France is, I believe, who you're talking about.
She's in it. No. She's not the character that I mean. There's another woman who I also recognize.
Ludovine Sagnier?
Yes, that is Sagnier. Yes, Sagnier? That is she from Swimming Pool and other French films. Diane Keaton, who walks around wearing a t-shirt that says, I'm a virgin, but this is an old shirt, is the woman who effectively raised him. He was effectively her adopted son. She ran the monastery where he was. There's this whole thing about a rivalry, a friendly rivalry between he and another kid who was there, and they were sort of raised together. It is sort of a variation on the anti-hero, like bad boy, mercurial man type that we saw in that Mad Men and Breaking Bad really exhausted, in addition to a number of other shows. It does not feel as intellectually rigorous or as interesting as really either of those shows. And I think I'm most intrigued by this other character who is played by a wonderful and idiosyncratic Italian actor who is as cartoonish in his own way as Issei Ogata is in Silence, as the Inquisitor character, and has a wonderful mole. It's very expressive. But the powers trussles are interesting.
I have a small question, but I think an important. Jude Law with an American accent, I think, is a crime. Is it as bad as I'm imagining?
I mean, it totally works for his sneering, arrogant thing. I mean, he pulls it off with aplomb. I'm sure he's done it before, no?
In Spy, I believe, is the last example I can think of.
I completely buy his character. I was not in the five episodes that I saw always convinced that there was a lot going on beneath the surface, that this show had enough meat on its bones to sustain it. But beyond being a power struggle for the papacy, I think the most common angle that people are going to use to approach it, you've already seen this happening. Sorrentino was already asked about it at the TCAs, and it's inevitable, even if he could not have anticipated how relevant it would be, is that it's almost a shame that we've already wasted this is perfect for Trump's America. This parallels Trump's America takes, because here's a show about a brash young leader. We have a president who may not believe in democracy, and now there's a show about a pope who may not even believe in God, and says as much, and then tells his aide, "Just kidding." And you're like, "Oh, keep hope." This is that kind of show. There is a montage where he gets dressed, set to "I'm Sexy and I Know It."
Wow.
He does turn to the camera, one pope, and say, "I'm a young pope." But it is very much a show where you can imagine if Donald Trump were about 400% cagier and more deliberate.
Cagier? Jesus.
I mean, yeah, he's a. Donald Trump is a fucking moron.
What is the plot?
You mean like
thread.
Cleverer?
Yeah.
What is Young Pope doing in this show?
Young Pope is essentially. Well, we don't know. I mean, we don't know what his end game is. He obviously wants to sort of change the culture of the papacy, but we don't know to what end. We don't really know what motivates him. Think season one Don Draper in a way. But in the first episode of Mad Men, you understand that Don Draper's picture-perfect private life is not syncing up with his actual life, his desires. The image of him as an American man is not dovetailing with his actual life. Here, it is a little bit more opaque. There's a power struggle going on for sure. I don't know how it's going to go on in the last five episodes of this first season, but it's kind of interesting. I suppose I'll tune in. I felt less involved in every subsequent episode.
But let me ask you one more question, because you mentioned at the top of this segment about Sorrentino directing it being kind of peak auteur television, and the one thing that I really connect with in the films of his that I've seen are how he considers music. I feel like he considers music costuming in some way, especially in The Great Beauty, but even in like This Must Be the Place, the Sean Penn movie.
This Must Be the Pope?
Yeah, This Must Be the Pope. How does music play a role in this television series at all, or is it, I mean, especially with the religious music that could crop up? I don't know.
I'm sure that it does. I would be lying if I told you with my faulty memory exactly in what way, or if as overtly as it has in his previous films, but it is in every way a Sorrentino joint. And so I'm going to override even my memory and just say that the answer is probably yes. Gotcha. But interesting note to close this segment is that one of the songs that features very prominently in The Great Beauty is sampled on the new XX album, which was a surprise to me. You'll know it when you hear it. It's like the very sort of like choral chanting one. Okay. You know.
I think,
like,
I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Dave, thoughts on Young Pope?
I've seen the opening sequence and I'm torn on if I like that remix version of All Along the Watchtower, but in terms of opening sequences, setting the stage for a series that could be what David describes, I think it syncs up pretty well.
Watch The Crown on Netflix. It's like Young Pope, but better.
I might probably be doing both.
We'll talk about The Crown
soon. You have to choose.
What? Oh.
Sorry, Dave.
next week, we're sending Patches and David off to Sundance, where they'll be sharing an apartment. Oh, no, not sharing an apartment for the first time in a couple of years, which is a shame. They marry. Well, we can dream of the days when you
guys slash fiction is dead.
Stayed up late drinking hot chocolate. Anyway, I won't be there, but I have some things that I'm interested in. And we just wanted to go down the list and point out each of us one thing that we think is worth paying attention to at Sundance, either if you're attending to see or if you are watching from afar to hear how it goes.
Especially because it's going to be harder this year probably than ever before to cut through. Oh, I don't know. Maybe the inauguration of our new president could be.
Well, you know, if you want something to pay attention to that isn't inauguration, Sundance Buzz sounds pretty good.
Wait, we have a new president.
It's coming.
I have never been more jealous of everyone going to the mountains to sit in movies all day, because that sounds much better than watching the inauguration.
I'm going to be taking many.
Did President Trump bring back XXX, like the original XXX, not our, you know, Bush era XXX?
There he is. He's back. The return of Xander Cage. That is not premiering at Sundance, unfortunately. One film that is, that I'm going to mention now, is it's part of the next category, which is where I go to find most of the gems.
Is that the category where they play a movie and then 5 minutes in you go, next?
Yeah, it was inspired by MTV's Next. Classic show. No, these are actual small budget films that Sundance still nurtures and makes room for between all these giant premieres. And one film I'm looking forward to is called Lemon. And if you look it up, it has a picture of comedian Brett Gelman, standing in his underpants in front of cameras. And that could be the most Sundance-y image, like Napoleon Dynamite-y image. But I have faith in this one. So the director, I'm going to mispronounce her name, but it's Janixa Bravo, has previously done some short films. She made a film called Gregory Go Boom with Michael Cera, which is on Jash. Have you ever guys made it over to Jash on YouTube? Which
what?
What the hell are you talking about?
What are all
Jash.
These
on Jash, obviously. Jash is huge, actually. No, Jash is a big comedy website owned by, well, it's a comedy YouTube channel owned by Sarah Silverman, Michael Cera, and Tim and Eric. They're like, they team
Holy
up.
Holy shit.
In fairness, Jash was my favorite one of Elsie's boyfriends on Laguna Beach.
Fuck you guys. People know what I'm talking about. Jash. I'm just going to scream Jash. Fake Jash. So anyway, she made this film called Gregory Go Boom. It's on Jash, which you can just search for Gregory Go Boom YouTube, starring Michael Cera. And it's a very, very peculiar kind of comedy about a paraplegic man who kind of goes out on his own. And just bizarre. Great bizarre tone. And Lemon is her feature debut. And this is the description is a person or thing that proves defective, imperfect, or unsatisfactory. A man whose blind girlfriend is leaving him, whose career is going nowhere, and whose family is disappointed in him. Isaac Lockman is 40. He doesn't know how he got there. Things were supposed to work out differently. Oh, so Sundance.
If your grandparents knew that they came over to this country so that you could say things like, from the woman who made Gregory Go Boom on Jash.
You know
ashamed.
What? These are the things that we overlook or we underrate, and this will pop. I bet that's what I'm hoping.
I am very excited to see this movie. I must admit, I hear good things about its maker, and I like Brett Gelman.
Yeah, she seems like a really interesting cat. So we'll see.
Yeah.
All right, David, you're also going to Sundance. What are you going to see?
I am. I'm also going to highlight something from the next section. Although I will say that this year's competition titles and spotlight titles are a little bit less flashy than they were last year and maybe into previous years before that.
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to find a Manchester by the Sea this year or something like that.
Yeah,
I don't know. Maybe.
It's going to be interesting. A few of those movies sort of maybe you've gone the can route. Suddenly you have your Alex Ross Perry's and Gillian Robespierre's. It's like the elder statesman of Sundance. It's interesting. Anyway, I am going to pick a film that I have actually seen, but I am not allowed to talk about. So this is not a review, but hey, I've seen it and I'm choosing to shout it out. So make of that what you will, which is the first anything really of a video essayist that the internet knows as Koganada. He has made a number of the very best video essays. The one about, I mean, the very popular ones that first got him into the field were about the central perspective of Kubrick's films and hands in the film of Robert Rosson and top-down shots of from Pulp Fiction. And then they've really evolved. They've tapped a lot into he's done beautiful works that go in depth into the films of Hirokazu Koreeda and Ozu. He did an amazing piece called What is Neorealism? He is a and his films are his video essays are very they are very unlike a lot of the video essays you see now, even the ones that had narration, because they don't seek to prove a point or sort of talk at you to bully you into sort of conceding what they're saying. There's no arrogance to them. They're really poetic. They operate on feelings, something ineffable. They sort of pair, they have this sort of dual access between presence and absence and focus on temporality. They're really beautiful things. He's made them for Criterion, Sight and Sound. And unbeknownst to me, went off and made a feature called Columbus, which stars John Cho and one of the Culkins and Haley Lou Richardson from Split and The Edge of 17 and Parker Posey. And I have described it, hopefully not insultingly, as a cross, as a Garden State if it were directed by Ozu. It's, I'll say this, that not about the film itself. It's very neat that we have a video essayist who has very seamlessly made the transition into making features. And I think just speaks to the idea that, in the 21st century, in 2017, a great filmmaker can come from anywhere and they come in all shapes and sizes. And there are any number of avenues towards getting your work financed and shown. That's great.
All right, Dave, you and I can go fast since we're not seeing this shit for months.
What do you want to
see from Sundance in months?
Well, see, my pick, we might not have to wait that long because I'm going to choose Casting JonBenet, Kitty Green documentary. She had the winner of the short film nonfiction jury prize last year, right? The Face of Ukraine, The Casting of Osaka by Osana Bayul. Anyway, but she's back this year. She came with Scott McCulley and James Shamus, two other producers, to Boulder, Colorado to sort of dig into how the JonBenet Ramsey murder affected the community. And good news for everybody, it's premiering at Sundance, but Netflix has already acquired it and are
nice.
Looking to air it for everybody in this spring.
Nice.
Is your mom interviewing?
I don't think anybody I know is interviewed in it, but you gotta wait and see, I guess.
She's big into casting movies, huh?
That's her
thing. Where's she gonna go next?
I'm picking something that looks like a bad idea on the surface for everything except for one thing, which is Call Me By Your Name, which is an adaptation of this novel about this boy who's living with his academic parents on this island in Italy and kind of has this affair with with a student who's living with them. It's very sexy and coming of age novel. It stars Armie Hammer as the kind of object of affection. And it all sounds like something that is a book that shouldn't be adapted because it's very internal, except that it's directed by Luca Guadagnino, the director of A Bigger Splash, which, David, I know you and I both really like.
Yeah.
This guy basically seems to be directing Your Dream Vacation with a twist in A Bigger Splash. It's, Dream Vacation, then Murder, and Call Me By Your Name is Dream Vacation, and then, 13-year-old sexual longing. Anyway, I'm super curious to see if this worked out at all. James Ivory is a co-screenwriter, which I just found out looking at the Sundance website, so that's fascinating.
Wait, what?
Everything about it is fascinating. I know. Yeah.
And the film was already purchased by Sony Pictures Classics, which you would hope speaks well to its quality.
It seems super potentially odd and maybe super stiff and like a prestige picture nobody needed.
It'll be stiff, all right, Katie.
Indeed. also, if you really want to pretend you're going on a summer vacation, read that book right now.
If I had to say something really stupid and just blindly guess at what my favorite film from Sundance would be, which is a completely stupid exercise because A, wait till you see the movies, and B, Sundance is really all about discovery and being taken by surprise. I would not be surprised if this were my favorite film of the festival.
Or I would not be surprised if it is a complete misfire that never should have been made. It really feels like it could be
one way or the other. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
David just jumped on the thread and said, first.
That's first.
I love this movie, and I haven't seen it yet. Best Picture 2018.
Best Picture, yeah, right.
And that's Sundance.
City of stars, are you shining just for me? City of stars, there's so much that I can't see.
So when the Oscars nominations come out at the end of this month on January 24th, there will be a number of titles we've been talking about on this show throughout the fall, and then probably some that we haven't gotten into because release dates and our schedules and the way things come to Denver can really determine a lot of how we see things and in what order. And I think for a lot of people, a lot of the movies that we have been talking about for months are only now making their way to you. So we wanted to kind of have an Oscar movies catch-all conversation about some stuff we haven't talked about, checking in on the stuff we have. And I kind of want to start by turning to Dave, who, being in Denver and not going to festivals, sometimes catches stuff later than we have. Dave, anything in the conversation you have caught recently that we have neglected or you want to chime in on?
Well, it was interesting. My girlfriend and I went to like our local art house theater to catch La La Land finally. And the guy or the theater manager got up at the beginning and they sort of, you know, give an onslaught of what's coming. And like, we're just getting Patterson and 20th Century Women this weekend. And I was like, goddamn Patches spoiled Patterson for me. And Java was like, what? And I'm like, don't worry about it.
How does one spoil Patterson?
Thank
but
you.
we did go out of our way not to spoil the best joke in Patterson. So when that comes, hopefully you'll be glad.
Oh, for sure. So we have those like plans to catch up. But yeah, I finally caught up on La La Land. It was fine.
But Young Love.
I mean, Young Love. I enjoyed the night at the movies, and it was inoffensive until you really thought about it. And
the popcorn
then
was good.
What happened when you really thought about it?
La La Land's only offensive if you don't think about it.
Ooh. Java and I were having a discussion about how much we're supposed to be on the Ryan Reynolds character's side.
Ryan Gosling.
I did the same thing this morning.
You're definitely supposed to be on Ryan Reynolds' side. But
that's what I was saying, is like through the filmmaking and like especially the scene where we, you know, see the, I don't know, what to me feels like overused literary trope of water leaking through the ceiling to show a character's discomfort with their current, I don't know, mental state. I was like, yeah, I think we're pretty much supposed to be on your side. But if there was a version of La La Land where we were entirely on the Emma Stone character's side, I feel like, I don't know. I feel like everything in the movie was just like, stop talking. Like, the movie's so visual and the songs are good enough that like all of the talking stuff, even like if we're stopping to do like band photography jokes, I'm like, don't do this.
I don't understand the argument of being on either of the character's side.
That's what I was about to say. What side is Ryan Gosling on at the end? What do you mean?
The side that Jazz should never age or change.
Oh my God.
And John
but
Legend
he's not.
Wrong.
He's achieved his goal, but he hasn't. So his arguments about Jazz seem kind of moot because it's all.
What I
well, no, it's
so
a, it's a. They both. They
what
both are in a balance about how to achieve your goals is the thing. So like he ends up where he's, you know, monetary responsible.
Spoiler
and he's, like,
for
his,
La La Land.
Yeah. I guess. Are you watching it for the plot? I wasn't watching it for the plot. I don't know. It's a beautiful movie, and it has like some great songs and stuff, but I think I got overhyped just by time.
One
then,
of my
like,
favorite
a lot of
things
my peers...
about this movie is engaging in the conversation of if the characters get what they want, get what's good for them, if the movie sides with them, if it doesn't. I mean, I think it's a lot more complicated and involving and deliberate that confusion than audiences were willing to take. And I think that a lot of them fell into a trap and were irresponsible as viewers.
What do you mean? Like, people are
really
having that conversation.
Me.
That is not...
No, a lot of people are not having that conversation. A lot of people are simply, like, taking... they're not having that conversation. They're not
agreeing with you. That's why you don't think they're having the conversation.
No, that's not what I'm saying. They don't believe that they are in a dialogue with the movie. They think the movie is saying one thing, and then they are judging the movie for giving them the options to do this. They are judging the movie for their interpretation of the character rather than understanding that the movie has is giving you this conflict. It's to
right.
work through it and find your own answer about it.
They're reading the ending
reductive.
As a point as opposed to
I
reading
think,
the ending as a question.
Exactly. Fine. It's infuriating and I don't think people are good enough for movies anymore. I think it's part of the problem.
Although, no, I
mean,
you know.
But that's a tough dichotomy to hold, is to have a movie with, like, weird, sketchy values when outwardly your plot is, like, simplistically built on musical beats. So, like, I just don't think, like, if it had that complexity, I don't think it made that leap for me. But apparently it did, because I'm having the conversation. I'm just not sure if that's because of a successful movie.
I don't understand this idea that the plot is, like, incredibly simple the entire time. From the very, very beginning of the movie, I mean, the first lyric in the movie is about a girl leaving her boyfriend to go to Hollywood and follow her dreams. And it is this very involved clash between, you know, self-interest and dreams and what we're told to want for ourselves versus being with other people and the things that our dreams cost us and so on. And it is a conversation that it only gets more nuanced and more involved as the movie goes on. I don't think the movie gets anywhere near enough credit as it should for the complexity of the dilemma that it's articulating. And it really popped to life for me, especially the second time that I saw the movie, as did the music, I must say. I thought the music was much better the second time around, and some of those songs have really grown on me. I don't know. I just think that I go back to the does Martin Scorsese endorse Jordan Belfort argument as like the end of the end of intelligent conversation about film. Oy. Anyway.
Oh man. I guess we are not.
Well, the other three of us,
I think
La La Land is flawed but interesting and often amusing. I mean, I'm not down on La La Land, but I've seen it three times now, and I have complicated feelings about it. I think the music is quite good. I think I actually, on the third watch, I realized that I wanted more from the middle section. I wanted this turn.
Did it took you three watches to figure that out?
No, see, I thought my problems were the middle section the first time, and then the second viewing erased those problems.
I'm saying I wanted actually more. I wanted a more deliberate or a slower entry. This kind of diffusion of the musical aspects to getting into this talky part of the movie, it feels a little jarring, and maybe it should, but I think there's a more elegant way to get there if it had a little more room to breathe. I don't know. That's just me. And I don't – the more I think about it, the way that the opening number, which is astounding, is totally kind of disconnected from the rest of the movie for me. I mean, I know that it's kind of setting up a thesis for people in L.A., I just wish it had more connective tissue, that it felt like a cohesive whole instead of these set pieces.
What?
That's all. Hey, I think what I think. I feel what I feel, you know? I guess I'm not alone. There's a lot of backlash to this movie. We were just, Katie,
really?
We were just talking to someone
today.
What
I figured out this week is that La La Land is the Shakespeare in Love of 2017, or Shakespeare in Love was the La La Land of 1998.
Hang on.
But wait, I'm just saying. I wasn't saying that I agree with backlash of the movie.
I'm not accusing you. Nor am I really, in truth, dismissing all those who don't overwhelmingly love the movie. But I do think the backlash is eminently predictable in the same way that, well, it's very similar as a film to Shakespeare in Love. But also, I think that whenever you have an Oscar frontrunner,
You're hearing backlash from an Oscar bubble. You're not hearing real people talking about the movie when you're what you're
don't
describing.
Don't get at me with bubbles. let's banish the B word, please.
Pop.
But I do think that when you have a Oscar frontrunner or strong contender that is on the lighter side, the frothier side, that certainly anything that has to do with a showbiz satire, we saw this with Birdman, which is a movie I don't enjoy very much. There is a very predictable. The artist.
We're not even talking about the Oscars. I don't know.
No, I'm just saying that there is what's the word? I can't even think of it. Blowback. What? I can't even. Backlash. Yeah. Is inevitable.
There you go.
Yeah, hating the Oscar frontrunner is kind of part of how this whole season works, which is why
that's right. Deadpool 2017.
Oh,
Jesus Christ.
Deadpool getting in that Oscar race. I still haven't seen it. I guess I probably should.
No.
Dave, anything else you finally caught?
I caught Moonlight. I don't know if we've talked about it since then, but I don't have like much else to add.
Yeah,
I think I did
talk a lot about it on our top 10 episode.
On the top 10s for sure.
Yeah. So like I don't know if I've seen anything that we didn't talk about in the top 10s, but I have been enjoying just on the side of being in the period of the year where there are good movies. And I'm like sort of dreading like February and March of this year already, even though I guess Deadpool gave us was February last year.
50 Shades Darker, man. It's coming.
Just twist the knife on this Deadpool shit. Jesus.
It was obviously the benchmark of superhero cinema, David.
Dave, did you see Silence yet?
I have not seen Silence yet. It's not available for me to see yet that I know of.
Really?
I thought it opened wide.
Yeah, it opened and bombed, so you may want to hurry.
Oh, shit.
Silence is the weirdest movie. Why did they hold on to it? Maybe it wasn't done. They rushed it out into theaters. It's a very peculiar release because I don't feel like it's been promoted a lot. Maybe people out there across the country who listen can tell us if they've seen like commercials for Silence or if they've seen it. I just don't understand putting this movie out like this.
Oh, this is a small, wide release, but you're right.
Scorsese's been working on this movie for 20 years. Why is this not a huge deal? It's crazy.
It's
a good question.
I don't think it had anything to do with the post-production schedule. I just don't think that they knew what to do with the movie. It's a difficult
sell. It seems like Paramount's pretty convinced that no one's going to want to see this movie.
I mean, Scorsese is convinced that no one wants to see this movie because I attended a Q&A with him, Thelma Schoonmaker, and the producers, and they're all resigned to the fact that it's not going to make money, that it costs too much, and they struggled to get the budget down, and that it's all tied up in legal fees, so that's what took forever, and no one thinks it's going to be a success. Yeah, they had to kind of fight for the rights for a long time. Fight for the rights to make silence. But yeah, now it's finally here, and it's a total bomb. Except the movie's pretty wonderful.
Wonderful, huh? I haven't seen it, so talk to me.
I don't know if I could ever watch it again. For people who don't know.
That doesn't put it in the category of wonderful movies automatically, but keep going.
No, I was just, my jaw was on the floor most of the time because the images are stunning and the text is so dense, the conversations about God, and as David was complaining earlier about how people think that Scorsese kind of endorses the actions of Wolf of Wall Street, Jordan Belfort, and that kind of nonsense, we're seeing so many different takes on Silence and if it endorses these two Jesuit priests. You know, this movie is about two 17th century Jesuit priests who travel from Portugal to Japan to find Liam Neeson, who was their mentor, and he's off spreading Catholicism in Japan, which was okay for a little while and is no longer. The Japanese are... what are they doing to them, David? Are they taking them captive? They're torturing them? They want them out. They do not want the spread of Catholicism anymore.
Exactly.
And they're making the Catholics apostatize. And so the
step
two Jesuits,
on your Jesus.
Yeah, the two. Yeah, and they have to step on the face of Jesus on a block. And there are scenes in the movie where people's feet are just hovering over Jesus' face for like very long extended periods of time. So it's kind of a covert mission movie for a little while. Andrew Garfield and Adam Driver wash up to the shore of Japan and they're trying to be very covert, trying to sniff out Liam Neeson without getting caught by the Inquisitor, who is hunting down the remaining Christians so that he can torture them. And also hunting down the Japanese who've converted to Christianity or at least kind of clinging to the Christian God. And it's such a complicated, nuanced film. I mean, there's long stretches where they're in Japanese towns in hiding or even bits where you're just watching the waves of Japan go by as Andrew Garfield's sitting there dying inside, hoping that he can find his mentor.
Did you know that Andrew Garfield was a guest on Katie Rich's other podcast this week?
Indeed,
Little Gold Men. Yes, I did.
Can you tell us about that?
He came in person with his croissant and his smoothie from the Condé Nast cafeteria.
How was his hair?
Oh, so nice.
Is he promoting this?
Like
or
luxuriant? This and Hacksaw Ridge. He was just kind of like, you know, on the circuit. He had been on Colbert the night before. So, you might have seen him.
Silence is podcast desperate, is what you're telling me.
I mean, I think silence is everything desperate. But Little Goldman is a very desirable destination for people, David. No, he was really nice and really handsome and just has like a gentle spirit about him, which I feel like I've seen in all of his movies and I imagine is present in Silence.
Well, I mean, I think
he'll still
phenomenal.
Be my Spider-Man.
He's phenomenal in this movie because what he's dealing with is so complicated. It kind of reminds me of Willem Dafoe in Last Temptation of Christ, who's just trying to understand the meaning of being God's son and like wrestling with this monumental force sitting on his shoulders and becoming that and becoming a martyr and dying for humanity's sins, like the weight of that. And then suddenly you just...
Wait, are you talking about Hacksaw Ridge or Silence?
not Hacksaw Ridge. he'll get nominated for Hacksaw Ridge, but I'm definitely not talking about Hacksaw
There's
Ridge.
There's no way.
He definitely will.
He definitely will, David.
Really?
Yeah,
but this
man.
Is the performance that he deserves.
Best actor's a weird crop this year.
Okay, I am like pretty tuned in to the Oscar world, and for whatever reason, I'm not doubting Katie in the least bit. I'm just saying that for whatever reason, the idea of an Andrew Garfield nomination completely eluded me.
I believe he got Golden Globe and SAG nominations.
Really? I mean, he was at the Golden Globes, but I just thought it was in general support of those films.
I'm just here to support Emma Stone.
Because I couldn't believe that he had been nominated for Hacksaw Ridge. Like, I just couldn't fathom. My brain couldn't make sense of that.
Yeah, he got a BAFTA nomination, too.
His scenes with Hugo Weaving in the beginning of that movie are, like, some of the finest comedy I saw on a movie screen in 2017.
I believe you have seen Walk Hard and the scenes early in the movie of The Wrong Kid Died. I'm pretty
the
sure.
Wrong kid, yes.
Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah, he got a SAG nomination, too. He's definitely getting an Oscar nomination.
Oh,
sorry, man.
Oh, God. I mean, was he nice to you? You had a good talk? He was
so nice. Yeah, I'm rooting for Andrew Garfield under all circumstances, okay, even though Hacksaw Ridge is not very good.
Fine. I support him as a person. I saw him stand up and cheer for his ex-girlfriend when she won a Golden Globe, so that's a Menschy thing to do.
But
they
what about
like,
Silence?
They seem to get along pretty well. What about Silence?
Silence is a fascinating movie, but I think the time to talk about Silence will be like 10 years from now. I don't really think that it fits into what? The Oscar conversation.
I mean, it's not part of the Oscar conversation, but I think it speaks to the density of the movie that it's not going to be an Oscar contender. There's just too much to wrestle with. I was sweating watching these guys almost apostatize or not, or wrestle with the fact that they believe in God or they don't, or watching Andrew Garfield sit as Japanese men and women are tortured in front of him, it's up to him to denounce his Lord in order to save their lives, and he refuses. Like, all of this, the weight of this movie, it's so hard to watch, but it's pretty...
I am not sitting next to you at the next Martin Scorsese movie.
I got so sweaty.
Sure.
I would just touch your face. I would have been covered in sweat. I'd be like, oh,
so
not
wait.
Religious moment.
This is the same religion that the leader of which is now Jude Law crawling out from a pyramid
yes.
of babies, right?
Everything is connected.
What a time to be a Catholic.
The best part was when Andrew Garfield was trapped in a prison, then the young Pope flew in and bashed down the wall and saved him.
From a pyramid
like
of babies.
I like to joke about how Jewish Silence would be a short film, because they'd just be like, step on your whatever, step on your Torah. And like 95% of the world's Jews would be like, all right. We get Japanese food now? This is great. I think Silence is a fantastically interesting movie, but I also think what I mean when I say that I don't know if it's worth lumping into the Oscar conversation, even though I sort of brought it up. I don't think it's a great shame that it's not getting the hosannas that it might deserve. Is that it's such, as Patches is saying, it's such a rich, thorny text that I think it will really just lend itself to revisiting it over the years and unpacking it as time goes on. So I think Silence will have a long afterlife.
In heaven.
So the movie that, unlike Silence, a lot of people are seeing is Hidden Figures, which I don't think we've talked about. It opened qualifying for Oscars. It's just kind of just making its trip out into the world now. And it's the movie that I feel like I most easily have recommended to people, like trying to figure out what they're going to see. You know, like depending on who the person is, like most people should see Moonlight. But, you know, for the people who you're not so sure, Hidden Figures is easy. But I don't, like, is it a good movie? Is Hidden Figures good?
What is it about?
All right. It's about these three women who are working for NASA in the 60s in Virginia, who were all real people who were kind of doing the mathematics that made rockets go before we had computers. There are actually people called computers, like a whole room of computers who made the calculations and the most prominent...
Computed the calculations.
Who computed the calculations. Yes. Yeah, so the most prominent one is played by Taraji P. Henson, this woman, Katherine Johnson, who kind of worked on the Apollo 8, whatever sent John Glenn up to orbit the Earth. She kind of made the calculations that made that possible. And then there's these two other women played by Janelle Monáe and Octavia Spencer, who kind of have their own accomplishments. And they're black women in the Jim Crow South, so they're kind of facing discrimination and managing to do some, you know, fascinating mathematics, which is a field that even now people don't think women are part of. And it's triumphant and interesting and has three really appealing performers in it. But it's also directed by the guy who made St. Vincent, which is terrible. At some point, I was watching it at home, and Michael, as we paused it, said, okay, here's how I think all of these stories are going to resolve themselves. And they all did exactly what he predicted. But that didn't mean I didn't like it, watching it. But I still don't know if it's a good movie. Can someone help me out here?
It's a crowd pleaser. it sets out to be just totally digestible, Disney-ified history with fun performances.
Not made by Disney, but yes.
Yeah, but you know what I mean. Just like
it was made by Usher. History. Usher-fied.
Was it really? Usher-fied. but it's not. It's the kind of movie where
No, wait. Pharrell? Which one? Oh,
yeah, sorry. I thought you were making a weird joke. Pharrell is involved in this.
All right. Just because I didn't know that doesn't make me racist.
I think you just hit hidden fences of this podcast, Dave.
Yeah.
So, God damn it.
But it's
like Michael Keaton, I'll sleep well at night.
Where everyone is a stereotype, and I guess that's a weird way to put it for this kind of racial conflict movie, but they're just stock characters. Everyone is out of a movie, you know, and like Kevin Costner plays the head of NASA or whatever division that Taraji P. Henson is working for. The man has apparently never stood outside of the walls of NASA because he has never heard of racism. He didn't even know that there were segregated bathrooms at NASA. Oh, they're coming for me.
Yeah.
This is what happens when you talk about race.
Criticism against a nice movie. But it goes down so easy. It goes down so easy that it doesn't feel like real history. It kind of undermines everything they went against. Compared to something like Selma, where I just really felt the gravity of these guys standing up and doing what's right. I mean, that's not the situation that Catherine D. Johnson's in. She's not really facing... I mean, she is facing racism. Fucking Jim Parsons.
Yes, but she's
a total asshole. White.
Yeah, but she is, you know, employed with a good job at a place. Yeah, she's not, like, getting beaten by Selma police.
Yeah, I don't know how to describe what's wrong with this movie because it feels so good and everyone in it is really nice and satisfying. What's wrong with this movie?
I mean, I think that's what's wrong with it, is that it kind of goes for the easy way out every single time, even when it's talking about really thorny issues. And it lays out what it's trying to do and doesn't surprise you in any way in terms of someone's behavior. You know, it has, like, the people who are racist who kind of learn to be less racist. And it has the people who, you know, Kevin Costner, who's, like, hard-nosed, but, like, learns to relent. Like, it hits its beat so perfectly that it doesn't kind of leave you room to engage with it the way that you might want to. And the way that, you know, when you have someone like Taraji P. Henson who can do really surprising things as a performer, I think there are moments where she does that. And it kind of sets you up to know, like, the other movie that you could be watching. Mahershala Ali is also in this, it's worth noting, also of Moonlight, and is, like, totally charming. But when you see his role as, like, the handsome suitor in this compared to his much more complex character in Moonlight, you're like, ah, yeah, that's right. That's what
I
we
feel
could
like
be
The
seeing.
Help has more grit than this movie.
Ooh.
I like The Help.
I like The
yeah.
Help, too.
I think...
And I like Hidden Figures. I do, but...
Yeah.
I think Hidden Figures is a little bit more constructive, a little bit more coherent and sure of itself, and features better, less cartoonish performances. also asserts, in addition to Mahershala Ali, who's also in Moonlight, it also has Janelle Monáe, gives her an even bigger role than she had in Moonlight, and confirms that
she's a
there's
star,
nothing
man.
That woman can't do.
Oh,
Jesus.
Janelle Monáe is amazing. I mean, she's great in this in, like, a part that isn't super demanding, but she's so charismatic. No.
And
she's got screen presence.
There are parts in this that are super demanding, but
yeah.
She is great in it. Everyone is great in it. It's a good night at the movies. I think it's a good thing overall that it is being received so well and is being so successful. I would raise an eyebrow or two if it started winning all these Oscars, but... I have no problem.
I just don't know why this is a Theodore Melfi movie. He's such a hack. I gotta say it. St. Vincent.
Who would you put in that place?
Who do I wish had directed this movie?
Is that a Ron Howard joint?
You need someone with a light, and Ron Howard would do well with it. You need someone with a light touch.
But how would this script have been better served? I mean, it's a script that's made for a Theodore Melfi, and I think that he does write by the script that was written for him.
Well, you know what I would have rather seen? God, what is the guy who... This movie just needs a little energy. You know, they're counting down. Not only are they facing, you know, the racism of Jim Crow South, but Taraji P. Henson's Catherine Johnson is solving this crazy mathematical problem, and it's a countdown. Like, if they don't get it done in time, if this rocket launches without the right math, like, they're going to screw up huge. This movie needs real energy. I'm thinking of... who's the guy who directed Dope?
Rick Famuyiwa. Famuyiwa.
And Dope is not a movie I really like that much, but, like, Dope had a sense of time period and a sense of propulsive energy, this countdown, this we have a deadline, we got to get somewhere, point A to point B to point C. Great character actors. That's what this movie needs. Just
yeah, but he made his confirmation. The Anita Hill movie was pretty bland, so you know, maybe not everything. We brought up The Help, but Tate Taylor's Get On Up, the James Brown biopic, had a lot of texture to it and a lot of energy that I thought that movie well and could have served him really well.
But he's on the shit list now. Girl on a Train was awful.
I didn't see Girl on the Train.
Really bad.
Well, if you are with your family and they want to see Hidden Figures, don't roll your eyes. It is not a great movie, but it is highly enjoyable. And although it is crazy that Octavia Spencer is going to get the Oscar nomination for that cast because she's great in it, but Janelle Monáe is the one.
I feel like she's not in the movie very much.
Yeah, she has the smallest part of the three, I think.
When is Octavia Spencer going to get a great movie role? Like, Snowpiercer is her best role for me, or at least one of, maybe The Help, but she's in
You got something against the Divergent franchise?
She's in this upcoming, this Gifted movie, Mark Webb's Gifted, but it seems like she's also just a supporting character.
Yeah.
She needs a juicy role. Give this woman a great role. Ugh.
She was in Bad Santa too. Did you know that?
Good Lord. No, I didn't.
No, nor did I.
So is that the Oscars?
So is that what we? Anybody else seen anything recently they wanted to?
I just feel just to wrap this up. I guess there's a bunch of movies that are out now that no one's talking about, and I think they were supposed to win Oscars, but they're not, so they're just going to disappear into the ether. David, did you see Live by Night?
Oh,
the HBO movie that made it to.
Did I see Live by Night? What a train wreck!
Ben Affleck, Dennis Lehane movie, for those who don't know. It's out in theaters now. And I guess it made a play for the Oscars, but...
Yeah, that's not going to work out. I don't want to overflatter Mr. Affleck. I did not think that he was capable of directing a movie this bad. After watching The Town and Argo and still the best of his movies, Gone Baby Gone. It was just a basic competence in all that movies. In all those movies, rather, that it completely disintegrates here. I mean, this movie is just dead on arrival from the moment it starts. It seems poorly conceived, adapted from a book that did not easily lend itself to adaptation. I just think this is a train wreck. It is bombing. You will never hear this movie again until it's on TBS, at which point I advise you to change the channel.
Batman ruined Affleck.
Definitely got under his skin. Well, then the other movie I was thinking about was Gold, the Steven Gagan movie.
Awful. That,
again, no one is. It's not awful. It's not awful. It reminds me of The Founder, which is also out now and is also getting sucked up or overshadowed by the actual Oscar contenders and should have been there, I suppose. But like The Founder, it's just a very straightforward, over detailed kind of Wolf of Wall Street riff. About the reconnaissance is over. I think we can all agree. What came after the Renaissance? What's the new portmanteau we can use for Matthew McConaughey's name?
I don't know, but
the Bronze Age.
The Bronze Age.
I don't actually think that's right.
McConaughey's Age has begun.
The American Revolution. Hamilton, I think, is what came after.
Oh, okay, perfect.
Yeah, the McHamilton is over.
this movie is not bad.
That sounds like a delicious sandwich.
You hated this movie, David? It's just so straightforward.
It's very straightforward. I found it very very difficult to find anything about it to recommend. I think it looked good.
Basically, this movie sends balding Matthew McConaughey to the jungle to go look for gold and then come back to New York and be a Leonardo DiCaprio Wolf of Wall Street type. And it doesn't work for some reason. It just is so plain and straightforward.
Wow. This is finishing the siren.
Yeah. Every year, I mean, I think there was a Tumblr about this. I wonder if it still keeps up about the failed Oscar bait of
this past. Oh, Tumblr by our friend Joe Reed.
Oh, that's by Joe Reed?
Yeah. This had Oscar buzz.
This had Oscar. I did not know that that was by Joe Reed. The Gold is a future leading player in this head Oscar buzz.
As is live by night, I guess.
Indeed.
All right. I think that does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back next week to some extent. I'm not sure how we're going to work out Sundance Dispatches, but we'll hear from you guys one way or another, right?
Hopefully.
We'll yeah, somehow.
We're
somehow.
Not in the same they place anymore, phone. So we'll have to...
They have internet in Park City.
That's true.
Anyway, in the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches. I am the senior entertainment editor of Thrillist.com, and I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. And we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, you can share the episodes, and if you wanted to leave your quarter quill recommendation to win some of the posters, and you don't have a Facebook or you don't have a Twitter, then you can probably go on fightinginthewarroom.com and leave a message, and we will, or leave a comment, and we'll read that. So you have a lot of options. Fightinginthewarroom.com.
I am David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire.com. You can follow me at Sundance if I survive. And you can find all of us. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find all of us together on Facebook, Fighting in the War Room, where we will read whatever you say to us.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. I spelled my first name D-A-7-E. That's also my Twitter handle. We're still doing the Storm of Spoilers off-season tour over at stormofspoilers.com, where I had to watch The OA. And, oh, man, you are just going to be an interesting
OA
episode.
Man.
OA, man. OA.
Oh, and I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at vanityfair.com. I talk a lot about Oscars over there, and sometimes I talk to Andrew Garfield on another podcast that we talked about earlier. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, K-A-T-E-Y-R-I-C-H, and all of us are on Twitter at F-I-T-W-R, talking to each other and you about whatever you want, or maybe this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of the founder, what's your favorite Michael Keaton performance?
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.